Today's episode is brought to you by our company, Sales Schema. Sales Schema helps agencies and B2B service companies build a reliable business development system through tasteful and targeted outreach. To learn more about us and check out our latest video training, go to salesschema.com/takecharge.
And when I looked into the research, I looked into the history, we basically found five different principles to act upon for this. And so the first one is beneficial. So these are messages that prioritize the receiver, you know, features and benefits. We all kind of know that as marketers, like going back to freshman year, right? The second one is focused. This is the chase two rabbits, catch none type of situation. You don't want to say multiple things. You can really only say one thing at a time. Only be one priority, only one thing can be first. Third one is salient. Salient is when things stand out. They stick up, they're in contrast to the background. You have to be, you have to zig when people zag in order for that to be noticed. Empathetic is the next one. This means that we're speaking in the language of the audience, that we're using words and formats and language that they can understand, that we're not kind of dwelling in the jargon and the inside speak. We're able to kind of expand our view. And the last one is minimal. And you would think that minimal would be the first piece, right? Like that simple is just about cutting the words out and that's it. And simple messages are correlated with being minimal, being short, but that's not the only piece of it.
Welcome to the Digital Agency Growth Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Englander. Today's episode is brought to you by our company, Sales Schema. Are you tired of relying on unpredictable referrals to grow your agency or B2B service company? Yes, Dan, I am. So maybe you hired a salesperson or a lead generation company and your efforts failed miserably. So here's the problem. When it comes to selling agency services and other consultative offers, cold outreach doesn't work. And that's because there's so much competition and noise. And the scarce resource is not differentiators, at least not with the prospects who don't know you yet. So what's the scarce resource? It's actually trust. And at Sales Schema, we've worked with over 100 agencies and B2B service companies since 2014 to help generate qualified meetings and keep the pipeline full so our clients can achieve their dreams. And I've put everything we've learned into my book, Relationship Sales at Scale. And to learn more and pick up the book, you can do that by going to salesschema.com/RSAS. Again, that's salesschema.com/RSAS. Today on the show, I'm very excited to welcome Ben Gutman. According to his official bio, Ben is a marketing and communications expert and author of the forthcoming book, Simply Put, Why Clear Messages Win and How to Design Them. He's an experienced marketing executive and educator on a mission to get leaders to more effectively connect by simplifying their message. Also, he is a former co-founder and managing director at Digital Natives Group, which was based here in New York, an award-winning agency that worked with the NFL, I Love New York, Comcast, NBC Universal, Hachette Group, and The Nature Conservancy. Also, he teaches marketing at Baruch here in New York, which is something we got into. And we talked about how compelling that can be just to teach what we're up to the next generation of future marketing talent. So I had a lot of fun talking to Ben. A few things we covered. We talked about why you should ban the word help from your copy and your message. We talked about how the industry is changing and what inspired Ben to sell about a year and a half ago when he did. We talk about why we tend to trend towards complexity and what we can do about that. And we went through Ben's five-part framework for simplicity. So without further ado, please give it up for Ben Gutman.
Ben, great to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
Yeah, so we are across town from each other out in Midtown. You're out in Sunnyside, so could have done this in person, but I find that there's logistical difficulties to in person and that like the audio has to be more on point. Like we just did one of those and it was good, but I've gotten complaints about the audio because whatever, there's something just easy about Zoom for that reason.
We'll make up for a beer later at some point.
Yeah, I hope so. So you have a really interesting background kind of coming from the agency space and then focused on simplifying messaging, which I think is a really great topic. And I also like the way that you're sort of practicing what you preach with the design of the book. It's called Simply Put and everything like that. Before we get into that, and this is kind of a big question, can you talk a little bit about your background and how you got to this point?
Yeah, absolutely. So I ran a marketing agency here in Queens, in Long Island City, for about 10 years. It was called Digital Natives Group. Started that basically right out of college, right? So I was, you know, an old professor came up to us as we were graduating and said, hey, I run a marketing agency. We need some help with digital. Maybe we can figure something out. And so we His office was up in Westchester. We set up shop in their basement. We slapped their logo on the wall. Did that for about a year, and we realized we were a bunch of the knuckleheads that didn't know what we were doing. They had Fortune 500 clients, and we were trying to work our way up, right? And so we worked with like the local ice cream shop and the local camera shop and like a real estate guy. And so bit by bit, we start to do a little bit more stuff. And then flash forward a few years, we got an office in Long Island City where Four Kind of LIC blew up. We start hiring employees. We got a bigger office. We got more employees. And then eventually we ended up working with like the NFL and I Love New York and the Nature Conservancy and a bunch of cool brands. Sold that business about a year and a half ago. And it was a really fun journey, but it felt like a little bit of time to move on to something else. And the book, which comes out in October, is part of that something else. And it's also tied into kind of why part of the reason why we sold it was personal. Was saying, hey, it's time to do something else. Part of it was saying the entire industry is changing in a way that is harder to do things the same way we did them in the past decade. And we saw it was a good opportunity to say, okay, well, this is a pivot point for our team. And we ended up finding a strategic acquisition for that. And that ties into what we were writing here in terms of it's more about, I don't want to keep Bob blabbering on too much of his first question, but it's more about messaging and kind of the stuff that is harder and less about the blunt force of I'm going to hit people over the head 1,000 times with the same advertisement because I have the cookies tracking them everywhere else. That was one of kind of the sparks for saying this is the moment for the story.
Yeah, I think the thing to do is let's circle back to that. I really want to dig into how the industry is changing and what kind of inspired the book and also the decision to sell. One thing I like to do is we probably don't have the time to go through the whole 10-year journey because that's a long one. But what were those stages like? You could think about, it sounds like maybe you started the agency around 2010, 2011, if I have the math right there. What was it like then? When you look back on it, what did those milestones feel like in the agency?
Oh, man. I would say, let's see, where would I kind of draw some of these lines? I think that the time before we hired our first full-time employee is kind of that one chapter, right? I had a couple of friends I started with. We were from the very beginning in a service-based business. We don't really have, a factory or a storefront or a warehouse. So we were profitable from the beginning, but you're what they call like ramen profitable, right? You're not making that much money. You're making a few bucks and, we're getting paid less than our peers who graduated and went to go get a job somewhere. Right. And so that first chapter, getting that first client was a big piece of the puzzle. And then getting to the point where we were confident enough to say, okay, there's enough recurring revenue where we can hire an employee. That was the moment where kind of everything changed. It went from being, okay, this is a few guys doing something, as like freelancers, all kind of glorified freelancers to being, a year and a half in after we hired that first person. Okay, this is a real business now. We have to make payroll. We have to pay insurance. We have to pay rent and all these other things that begin to kind of weigh on you.
Right. That makes sense. And then what did it take to work with the NFLs of the world and get to that next level?
Oh, yeah. So, it's one of those like beg, borrow, and steal type of things, right? To get to where you got to be. We came into it without having clients brought with us, right? And I'm sure you've spoken to a bunch of people who have started agencies like the more traditional way, which is they worked at an agency or they work at a client and then they leave, set up their own shop, bring them with them. And all of a sudden they're starting day one with a book of business and a brand and a portfolio and everything else. We were a bunch of kids and we were trying to figure out what we were doing. And so it was very important to be intentional about the way which you told our story every time. And it wasn't, hey, we were working with like a camera shop. We said, we were working with the biggest camera shop that's the only licensed repair facility for brands XYZ in New York City. And they do all these great things for the photography community, whatever it is. And so you start telling those stories and you start punching up a little bit more. And then you get a few lucky breaks, right? Like the NFL had a small event called the Super Bowl, which was in town in, I think, 2013, I believe that was. They needed a social media team to be able to cover a bunch of the consumer products events that were happening. So they had stuff like Macy's, at Toys R Us, at Bath & Beyond. It's funny, that's been 10 years now and half of those companies are out of business. But we were doing all these different activations and we had to kind of manage the NFL style brand through that. So that was like that first foot in the door. We knew somebody that had an urgent need for something which we could provide. And then the off season comes and they say, hey, we kind of need a team to do stuff for the whole season. And then we start to pitch that project. We win that project. And bit by bit, it becomes something where we worked with them for over 5 years, I think, on their consumer product side.
Yeah, that makes sense. So to zoom forward a little bit, would you mind kind of setting the table for where you're at when you decided to sell? Like if you can, you don't have to get into revenues if you don't want to, but that or headcount and like, what did the agency kind of look like when you made that decision?
Oh, yeah. So we were an interesting, weird kind of group for a while, right? We had a couple different partners. We had, you know, this weird mishmash of work that we did because we fell into a couple different verticals. We did a lot of work in publishing, you know, that kind of led them to the book a little bit. We did a lot of work in travel and trade, tourism too. And so that was like this weird kind of like bedfellows. And we did a lot of work in the middle, like the NFL and Nature Conservancy and those type of things. We also, we had about 15 folks or so when we were at our peak there. We had design and development. We did websites, mobile apps. We also did a lot of branding and social media and email and those type of things. That is not the kind of business which if I was starting today, I would start again, right? That's just, it's messy. You have too many different types of stories you have to tell to different people, too many different types of people you have to hire to do different stuff. But it was something that kind of organically grew because of how we started. We were attractive to a number of different possible partners and acquirers over the year because there's always a certain kind of profile of the possible partner. They were a single or a partnership owner who was in their 50s or 60s who was saying, hey, I've been building this for 10 years or 20 years or 30, whatever it's been. And I want to maybe move on and do something else. I want to retire. I want to take a step back. But I look around at my team and I don't see anybody that really feels like, you know, is the person to run this. And they would look at us and say, well, these are some young guys that have done it, that have run an agency. They know how to do it. Maybe we can do some sort of acquisition and then they can turn into the leadership for the business. And so that's just a long way of saying, like, we had people knocking on our door to do that a number of times. It was an interesting experience. But we also, because we had all those opportunities, we saw a lot of people who were in that position, which is like, okay, what if we kept doing this for the next 10 or 20 years? And by all means, they're doing great, right? Like these guys, a lot of them have like houses out in the Hamptons and they're making lots of money and they're very happy with it. We just looked at ourselves and said, well, we did this for 10 years. We didn't go into this saying we're going to do this one business for the rest of our, for, you know, at the beginning of our career for our whole lives. And so we began to more proactively seek a way out that was a positive experience for our employees, for our clients, for everybody. And that was the moment that we decided to really jump in.
And would you mind talking about that? Like who was the acquirer and how did they find you or you find them and how did that situation come to be?
So yeah, the acquirers that I mentioned before, often they would find us, right? They would have a broker and they would go out and find us. Or there was somebody who we did work with at some point. We collaborated with them on something and they would come in. The buyers that we actually ended up working with, we found them through a broker. We hired a business broker to go out and say, okay, you know, put this package together. This is digital natives. They're really great. This is the revenue. This is their client base. This is who's going to come with or who's not going to come with. They went out and we had a lot of different interviews with people. We found a couple buyers. We actually broke the business into two pieces. So I mentioned it was like unwieldy apparatus between design development and the more marketing side. What we ended up doing was based on some of the feedback we got, we did a reorg and we did a new P&L and we had the marketing side of the business packaged up and we said, okay, well, my old partner, he's going to go with that. He's going to run that piece as a potential like business unit. And then we had the design development side, which, you know, that's the websites, mobile apps, those type of things. We packaged that up as a separate piece also. And I helped kind of get that piece sold as well. So the buyers, you know, to give you a sense of who they were. So we had a private equity buyer for the marketing side who was buying up a few smaller agencies and putting them together. And then the design development side, it was an agency out in California that was interested in kind of getting a New York presence. And so that was a really good fit for them.
Got it. That makes sense. And with that, you know, is there anything that you wish you knew then that you know now about the process? You know, any words of wisdom you can impart for anybody thinking about it?
It was a very interesting process. It was a very interesting process. It's a very stressful process because of the unknowns and because, you know, you're kind of being poked and prodded and valued and devalued depending on what you're doing. And so just kind of go into it knowing this is going to be one of the more unique experiences and maybe stressful experiences of doing it. And it's also stressful because you kind of have to, you can't be that public about it. You have to be, you kind of have to keep it under wraps because it's not real until it's real. And by exposing, saying, hey, we're actually thinking about selling, what that does is it makes clients go, okay, well, are you not in it to, you're not here committed to do great work for us? It makes employees go, well, should I look for another job? Is this not safe? Even though we made sure that both of those things were taken care of, it's still the kind of thing where you have to, like, those are the terms of the deal often with acquisitions, is you kind of have to keep them under wraps. It doesn't mean going online about anything, but it means you can't publicly discuss this with some of the people you're working with every single day. And so that adds this level of tension to the problem.
Yeah, I can imagine. So you've kind of talked about, you know, the internal reasons. It sounds like you guys wanted to do something new. You know, we're planning on being lifelong agency owners, and maybe there's more to it than that. To bounce back to where we were before, what were those external reasons? Like, how was the market changing, and what inspired getting out of that moment?
Yeah, I mean, we sold about a year and a half ago. We finished the transaction. And that was right as TikTok was beginning to really kind of run the show in terms of social media stuff. The first book that we launched, we worked with Dr. David Perlmutter on Grain Brain in 2013, about 10 years ago. We helped propel that to be like a number one bestseller. It was the best-selling book of 2014. It was a really fun project. David is awesome. And that was based off of Facebook. It was like Facebook, when you posted something organically in Facebook, if it was good content, we got 200% organic reach. Everything was shared 1,000 times. Everything went viral. It was so effective of a tool. By the time it was like fifth book came out, we could barely rely on Facebook to do anything for us. And so TikTok is where a lot of the energy is for that space, while at the same time, Twitter's fallen off fairly significantly, fairly quickly. Instagram has its own kind of suite of challenges to go along with it. But we looked at it and said, well, if you want to be really successful in doing especially social media side of things, you need to have a lot more video content. And it's really hard to do that content the way that we were working with clients. It was hard to do that stuff out of house. And everybody I've talked to is still having a hard time doing TikTok stuff out of house. Because it's better when it's like, hey, you're in the factory and you can take that photo real quick, or you can take a quick video and interview somebody. It's that you're in the office and you can kind of just interview random people and about some trivia question or whatever it is. Those type of things are really easy if you're there, if you're full time or you're in house. They're really hard when you're an agency who's cross town to get that same level of access. So that was one piece. The other piece was the death of the cookie, which has been, you know, kind of a long time coming and is still in the process. You know, when on one day, I think about a year ago, Facebook stock dropped by 20% because they reported a loss in ad revenue because of all these different privacy pieces that come from Google, that come from Facebook, that come from Mozilla, that come from Apple. And so that part of the puzzle was also something that was changing very fast.
Right. So it sounds like, you know, these macro kind of privacy trends, and then, yeah, and this was a year and a half ago, so it wasn't a million years ago. So I guess what inspired the book? How does that connect to the idea of simplifying messaging? And if so, how would you describe the genesis of the book?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, that I talk about in the insert of the book as saying, okay, this is why the book is important now, is that the stuff that worked for the past 10 or 15 years, stuff that we all did, and we advertised and spent tons and tons of cash on Facebook and other platforms to advertise, it won't really work in the next 10 or 15 years. It won't work in the same way, at least. Things change, of course. And so returning to the foundations of, like, what is a compelling message? The stuff that worked in the Don Draper days is going to be more important. We can't just shortcut our way to success in the same way as a marketer, as anybody, as an entrepreneur, leader, politician, advocate, faith leader, parent, whatever it's going to be. All of us, you know, we may not have done those other things before, but all of us have things to say and things that we need that are important and people we want to inform and persuade. And it's important. And as I began writing this book, it became more and more of a guidebook to say, okay, how do you get an idea out there? How do you communicate it? How do you, like, peel back the cover to put on that design? That's my background is in design, into a message.
As a quick break, I wanted to let you know about our newest video training, How to Take Charge of Your Agency's Future Revenue. By the end of this training, you're going to learn how we get 2 to 5 qualified appointments every week using tasteful and highly targeted email outreach. That might not sound like a lot, but once you understand the outreach napkin math,
you're going to learn how this can lead to massive scale for your agency or B2B service company. In addition to that, you're going to learn the 6 steps for successful outreach campaigns based on everything that we've learned from working with more than 100 agencies since 2014. You're going to get the complete agency outreach tech stack so you understand the right tools for getting the right results. And you're going to see agency to brand email examples and get inspiration from high converting campaigns. So to get this 30-minute training, all you need to do is go to salesschema.com/take charge. Again, that's salesschema.com/take charge. Yeah, let's dig into that a little bit more. So it seems like that's sort of timeless, right? The idea of simplicity in messaging. Can you talk a little bit more about what constituted a shortcut, you know, in terms of tracking people or iOS 14 and all the sort of thing of the previous era? Why was it less important to be on point with your messaging then as opposed to now? Assuming, and I'm not putting words in your mouth, but assuming I have that right.
Well, messaging was still important then. That's to give you a really good way to test things. Yeah. But it's kind of like blunt force trauma, right? If I just hit you 1,000 times with an ad for hiking boots, you're going to buy those damn hiking boots at some point, right? In politics, there's an idea that if you do voter contact 7 times, they're going to vote for you, basically, especially if they're kind of a swing voter. And so it's not to say that those things were, it was unimportant then, but you were able to get away with saying, hey, you know what? The most important thing is just the exposure part. I break it down to say there's only 2 parts of marketing. There's the vessel and its contents. The vessel is all that stuff. And the vessel changes all the time. When we're talking today, we're talking TikTok and we're talking email like that. If you're talking in 10 years, it could be something totally different. 10 years prior was something totally different. The content is, that's baked into what are our fundamental needs as people, right? Like it's baked into our psychology and those things don't change as much. So I think it's more durable. It's more lasting for us to really kind of build up that skill than it is just kind of chasing where can we get the cheapest impression for today.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So I guess one thing that, you know, you talk about in the intro to the book is the trend towards complexity, about how it's much easier and, you know, much more natural to complicate ideas, as I'm doing with this overwrought question right now. So I guess with that, why does that happen? Like, what do you think goes into all the junk accumulating? And it could be in an agency context or it could be in any marketing context.
Yeah, so there's some interesting research about it. We have basically a complexity bias. We are predisposed to add in any problem where you have an option to add, remove, change, our predisposition is to add. And there's lots of reasons for it, which when you look at it, you say, okay, well, adding is safe. Adding is, you know, there's evidence of your work. If you're in a corporate environment and you need to prove to your boss that you contributed something, being able to say, hey, look, I put that page on the website. Hey, I put that slide in the deck. All those things give you evidence that you contributed to something. And it's a good place to hide. It's a good place to hide by saying, I have more details. I have more stuff. I have more slides, pages, longer commercial. I put all those disclaimers in, whatever it is. All those things are a place to hide. But there was some research done there's an author, Lighty Klotz, who wrote a book called Subtract, which is, he does a great job of explaining his research there, where I'll summarize it and I'll probably mess up a couple of the details. But basically, the foundational study was they took this sculpture of Legos, and it was unbalanced. And they have the research subject change the sculpture so that it was balanced. And what everybody did, they didn't say anything. They just changed the sculpture to make the balance. Now, the sculpture was designed in a way where if you were to remove one block, it'd be balanced. But if you added 3 blocks, it'd be balanced. It needed more to add to get it to the goal than it did to subtract. Almost everybody added. Almost every single person went, and by default, if they were just said, change the sculpture, they added to it. And then they did the same type of thing with saying, like, here's a vacation itinerary. How would you make it better? And it was this like really complicated itinerary to go like visit Washington, D.C. and see all the museums. What everybody did was they added, right? And meanwhile, what most people would enjoy probably is saying, hey, you know, let's not visit 8 museums in one day, right? Like it was a track. And the only way that was completely foolproof to get people to avoid the additive bias or to tamp it down was to tell people that subtracting was an option. It was the availability bias. All you had to do was to say, hey, you can add or subtract. If you just said that, all of a sudden the scales even out a lot more by somebody saying, oh, subtracting is an option. And they remove that one Lego, or they remove the item from that itinerary, and it makes it a more effective end result.
Yeah, there's so much to dig into there. It reminds me of Peter Thiel, Love Him or Hate Him, has this idea of like, you know, maximum condensation, minimum disruption, right? Where it's, and I think that a lot of the times, at least I know in my head, if I'm simplifying, there's some part of me that's like, well, this isn't completely true now that you've simplified it, because there's this edge case over here. There's this other exception over there. And the question is like, are you, you know, how much do you shut up that voice, or how much is that voice valid and actually cutting against the truth of your statement? How do you deal with that?
Oh, man. Yeah, that's the whole book, right? So that reminds me, there's a piece in there where I basically, you know, there are some parts of this book that are very, what I've talked about, it's the science behind this and that. That's actually the first half of the book. Second half of the book, there's a lot more kind of like, okay, here's what you do about it. And there's, and one of the very tactical pieces I have in there that kind of relates to that is, you can ban the word help. People don't want things that help them. People want things that do, right? So I don't want the toothpaste that helps make my teeth whiter. I want the toothpaste that does make my teeth whiter. When you look at that, when you kind of strip those words out, who's going to be mad? It's going to be the edge cases, right? It's going to be people that are protecting you against that. It's going to be the lawyers and the compliance officer. And they're going to have an issue with that type of stuff. But when you're communicating, if you can just remove that kind of wishy-washiness, you're going to be a lot more effective in what you ultimately want to get across.
Right. That makes sense. And I think with that, to color this in a little bit more, I know there's a 5-part framework to how you come up with the simplicity. And would you mind taking us through that, time permitting?
Yeah, for sure. And so I joke about this in the forward, which is to say, it's a 208-page book, I believe, by the time the printer finally gets done with it. And it's about having simple messages. I obviously didn't really take my own advice in that, right? Like if you want the one sentence that you have to buy the book, is yeah, keep your messages simple to be more effective. But I mentioned design before, and that's right there in the subtitle, because design is about solving problems, right? It's a business function. It's not really an art function. It's related, but it's not. It's about solving problems. It's about, you know, arranging things in the world to get there, dealing with constraints. And so I wanted to figure out what are the like principles behind something that is simple. And when I looked into the research, looked into the history, we basically found 5 different principles to act upon for this. And so the first one is beneficial. So these are messages that prioritize the receiver, you know, features and benefits. We all kind of know that as marketers, like going back to freshman year, right? The second one is focused. This is the chase two rabbits, catch none type of situation. You don't want to say multiple things. You can really only say one thing at a time. Only one priority, only one thing can be first. Third one is salient. Salient is when things stand out. They stick up. They're in contrast to the background. You have to zig when people zag in order for that to be noticed. Empathetic is the next one. This means that we're speaking in the language of the audience, that we're using words and formats and language that they can understand, that we're not kind of dwelling in the jargon and the inside speak. We're able to kind of expand our view. And the last one is minimal. And you would think that minimal would be the first piece, right? Like that simple is just about put your words out and that's it. And simple messages are correlated with being minimal, being short, but that's not the only piece of it. Because what we're really trying to do is not cut out words, is not cut out pages, not cut out slides. It's about cutting out friction. And sometimes having more pieces to your message, having a couple more words in it, is less friction than having fewer. So you don't have to act on every single one of these every single time. But if you want to look and say, how do you design something, design a message that is easy to understand, easy to perceive, easy to act upon, the more you can act upon each one of these, the better you're going to be.
Yeah, that's super interesting. And what I love about the idea of kind of using a design mindset is this is something we think about a lot in our business, because we're sending sales emails for clients and for ourselves all day long. And what I've always noticed and hypothesized is that when you're making that snap judgment about whether you're going to read or respond to an email or agree to take time with somebody, it's as much about the shape of the email and this sort of lizard brain stuff than it is the actual content of it, right? Because like the sort of email that your friend sends you or that a client sends you just looks different than something an outsider usually sends you. Right. And it's like the shape, it's like what it looks like. And that absolutely applies in any sales or marketing context.
Banner blindness.
Say more.
Okay. So banner blindness, this has been documented going back to like the 90s, right? So like the early internet, before we got inundated, we have thousands and thousands of feet worth of content in our infinite scrolls. When UX researchers look at it, they find that, you know, they put little cameras, you know, on our eyes and they track it and they see how we're going around the screen. They find that we instinctively jump over banners. We literally do not see them when we are on a website. We have learned very quickly about what looks like an advertisement and we know how to avoid it. And so absolutely, you're 100% right. Like, we don't even see it because subconsciously we block it out before it gets there. So the visual component is very important.
Right. And it also, and I also think there's hidden costs in creating those ads. So if you're a publisher and you've got to serve ads, it's easier just to slap up whatever's there than it is to build something integrated, right? That takes thinking, it takes work and time. So there's other elements there. One question I had is, as you're going over the framework, you know, beneficial, focus, salient, empathetic, minimal, is how does the state of the buyer tie into that? So for example, if you have somebody that's completely cold or new to your ad or your message or whatever, my guess is you would have less time to drag them through material or to have them ingest content versus somebody that has already step-by-step gotten further into your funnel or climbed the trust ladder or whatever. So can you talk about that a little bit?
Oh, absolutely. I start off with the thesis that nobody wants to see your advertisement. Nobody wants to see read your marketing email. Nobody wants to go to your website. The big truth in marketing, you know, that I know, that probably everybody listening knows in an agency, is that nobody cares. Nobody cares. Nobody woke up today and had on their to-do list, let me go see some commercials. Let me go click on some banner ads. Let me go open some promotional email. That's not what any of us are motivated to do. And so because we start from that position that we don't want, that we're pushing against the tide here, I think that makes the case ultimately that simplicity is more important, because you only, if you do get any opportunity to break through in what you're saying, you only get this tiny, tiny little sliver. And so you need to make sure something that your message is sharp, that it is well-formed, and that it kind of gets in through there. And that's also why we start with beneficial, is it has to relate to what they do care about. Because if we're just going out and saying, hey, look at all these new features in our app, it's really great, nobody gives a shit. People care about what does that do for them. It's the so what? What's in it for me? And so that's what the entire process in there is to say, okay, how do we get down to the real root of what is going to resonate with people before we do everything else?
Yeah, that makes sense. Can you talk a little bit about context, right? There's a lot of ways that B2B and B2C are different. It's the same machinery you're dealing with. You're still just dealing with humans at the end of the day. But without putting you on the spot too much, are there any stories that you can talk about for how you've applied this maybe in a new business context when you're with the agency or in areas beyond just writing a consumer ad or something like that? It doesn't have to be in the sales world. It could be anywhere else.
Yeah, that reminded me of a project. It was a small project we did, but it still ends up being one of my favorite things. There's a power plant in New York City, and they provide about 25% or so of the electricity used by New Yorkers. And during Sandy, when the lights were out here, they provided like 50% of all the power that was still online. This power plant was being sold to juggle between owners for about a decade. It was owned by one company, it was owned by the third company out of Canada, this thing, whatever it was. It was the same power plant. It was the same employees, the same people that were really proud about the work that they were doing. And the newest round of owners, they reached out to us and said, hey, listen, we don't have to advertise, right? People turn the light switch on and the power goes through and they're not choosing us or not choosing us. But our employees have whiplash. They are just going back and forth and saying, okay, who's signing my paychecks? What company do I work for? What's the name on my hard hat? And our client was really savvy and said, listen, we don't care about a corporate brand for it. We want to brand the power plant and we want to have the employees be able to kind of look at the flag on the property, look at the signs on the door, look at the logo on their uniform and identify with that and be proud about that. So there was a design component, of course, to that, but there was also this branding piece. And after we sat there, we interviewed, you know, I'm sitting in this conference room with a bunch of just incredibly dedicated, kind of tough New Yorkers here who have been literally keeping the lights on for years. And I'm just asking them kind of, hey, what makes you get up in the morning? What are the misconceptions here? What are you proud about? What do you do? And I kept on getting this one sense. And so I jotted this down in my notebook. We went back, debated it. And we ended up giving them a tagline for themselves, which is making New York happen. And that's what they did. That was the reason why they got up every day was to say, hey, we're here to make New York happen. We're here to, so that when you turn the lights on, you don't have to worry about it. That everybody else that makes New York so great, the teachers and the doctors and the chefs and everybody else, they can do that. We do our job so they can do their job. And so we wrote this little manifesto for them that followed through that. And that ended up being one of the most satisfying projects in the world. Nobody saw it besides the few hundred people that worked in that power plant. But it was something that really still resonates with me.
Yeah. And to put you on the spot more, do you remember any of the previous clay that you had to shave off, right? The failed contenders and the overcomplications and anything like that? It could be with that or it could be with something else.
I'd probably have to go dig it out somewhere and see what else it was. But that's a good question. I probably should. It'd be fun. But yeah, everybody just gets in their own. They get in their own heads. They get in their own. This is what happens. I told this story in the book, and it was something that it reminded me of. Was one time I was sitting down to dinner with a few friends, and one of them was working at a company that just had a ton of bad PR. Like they had some product safety thing that was bad, and they were going to make fun of on it. News shows and on social media. And so, of course, as soon as you sit down, somebody else asks, so what's it like? What's going on? And this friend starts to parrot saying, well, it's unfortunate that this occurred, but da, da, da. And we all just started laughing because you and I have never said in conversation with friends that it's unfortunate that. However, that's what you write in the press release. That's the kind of language that would be that you see all over the place in those type of examples. But it's not how a human speaks. The better example, if you look at like crisis management, and this is out of the UK, was remember when KFC ran the chicken? That was like a thing a few years ago.
Vaguely.
So they had some traffic accident, the distribution facility, whatever it was, 900 stores, I think half of them didn't have chicken. And, they're going to make fun of them. They're going to roast it on social media for this. They're losing money every single day. And what's the typical response that somebody would have to that? It's, here's a press release. Here's a guy in a suit, up at some cameras apologizing, explaining things. Nothing's really wrong with that, but that doesn't help. That doesn't do anything. What they did was they took out a full page ad in the newspaper with their bucket turned upside down and said FCK instead of saying KFC. So it's fuck, we ran out of chicken. And then it goes on to say chicken restaurant without chicken. It's not ideal, And that alone, that little cheeky, self-deprecating, like talking like a human response, turned the entire narrative of that from being something where it's just kind of big corporate meltdown to being, okay, these guys have a sense of humor. It's a good brand. I want to be a part of this. And so I love that example.
Yeah, that makes sense. And how do you feel about the process of landing on these sort of wins, like making New York happen? Is this something that you think is best done solo? Is this a writer's room situation? Let's talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. So talk about this one. Talk about focus. I teach a marketing class at Baruch College here in New York. I've been teaching undergrads for about almost 10 years. This will be my 10th year starting in the fall. And I've had 1,000 students in my class, more than that. And every year I put them into different groups and they have to work on a couple of different projects. And one of them is I give them a brand. They have to develop a pitch, a lot like we're talking about, right? They give me a presentation, a proposal, for this brand that's having a problem. They always come back in a, mixed bag. Some of the students are really great to knock it out of the park. Some of them will fall into what I call the Frankenstein idea, which is that they have five members in their group. There's no formalized structure for their agency and they get together to brainstorm something, but nobody has creative authority on it. So what happens? Well, somebody shouts NFT, somebody stops drones, somebody stops AI, somebody stops, we're going to do influencers and we're going to write three different hashtags on the board. And all these things go out there. And instead of somebody sitting there and saying, nah, this one kind of sucks. This one's nice, but it doesn't really work. This is the one that really worked. What they do is they just take some tape out and just like wrap it all together and they throw it out there and they say, hey, here's everything. And when you look at Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, how they describe the monster is a lot of individually great parts, right? That has beautiful black hair and shiny eyes and this and that. But when you put them together, it's worse than the composite pieces. It's this like gruesome, hideous creature. That's what the Frankenstein idea is. When you have five different things, you just put them together. And so you make it one piece. Practically, how you avoid some of that is you have to have creative authority, right? You don't have to have somebody being a dictator. You need somebody to be a facilitator. So sometimes that's you working solo. Sometimes that can do great work. Sometimes you work with a team, it can do great work. But but avoid the like rudderless committee where it's just kind of this flat organization and there's no real goal for what you're doing. That's one piece of it. And then the second piece that I recommend and that the research backs up is thinking about the time which you're using for something. So we operate best under medium pressure. If something is a deadline where it's, you know, and I'm sure you know this from your work too, if the deadline is tomorrow, it's like, oh shit, I can't do anything. I got to copy paste from something else we did. I got to do the lowest, low hanging fruit. We got to just get it out there. We got to put out the fire. If the deadline's in a year, that's somebody else's problem. That's future me. I'm not future me. They're going to deal with that problem. But if the deadline is in this like kind of right little sweet spot where I have just enough pressure on, that's when we end up producing the highest volume and highest quality of creative work, tends to be in that medium spot. And then lastly, before I shut up about this, is the other time constraint is when you look at how ideas get generated in a meeting, the rate of idea generation basically starts high and falls pretty fast, right around like 6 or 7 minutes into a meeting, into like a brainstorm. And then it never really goes to zero. It kind of keeps trickling around, but you're often better like harvesting that creativity, you know, having more short meetings than saying, hey, we're going to get just 8 people in a room and you know, do whatever. Sometimes it's worth it because you get to kind of push past the groove, but sometimes that's going to be less productive than doing things that are going to optimize the output.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think one thing that we all have to contend with is the data, right? And like, where my head goes when you talk about Frankenstein is thinking about copy, where it's like this thing, we got this open rate, this reply rate using this thing over here. We got this other high open rate using this thing over there. So let's combine the two. I guess it's kind of a tough question, but how do you square your past experience, the data you have with just the art of this, the gut feeling that you have about, I think this is going to work and let's go with it. Where does data kind of enter the picture?
Oh man. So data is great for validating your stuff. Data's really not a guide. I mean, it can help you test things. And I advocate that for that quite a bit in the book, but it can't be your guide. You have to put kind of the human element back in for this. And there's plenty of data to back that up too, right? One piece that is another tactical piece, and this might be going back to something you said before instead of directly answering this, was if you replace and with so in what you're doing, that makes things a lot clearer in terms of how, if you want to include this, that, and the other thing. As you mentioned, you know, including this comes from the data, that doesn't. And so if you look at, let's say you have a cafe, you want to have repeat customers, you want to increase your return revenue. Well, if your proposal is we want to increase return revenue, and we're going to implement mobile ordering. Okay, that sounds like a complete English sentence that works generally. But when you put the word so in there to pull from, here's the first part, and then here's the second part. We want to increase repeat customers, so we're going to add a mobile ordering component to our app. Well, that kind of makes a little bit of sense, but it's not really actually directly related to it. You start to kind of raise that flag a little bit in your brain. And so it's better to say, you know, want to increase repeat customers, so we're going to implement like a mobile loyalty program with rewards. That ends up being a lot closer to what actually we want to do. So that's a little bit of an abstract example there, but it gives you a sense that when should you include something and when you shouldn't. If the data makes sense to help you kind of tie the causality together, that's great. But if you're just pulling data for the sake of pulling data, that ends up being a lot less effective.
Yeah. And what I think is interesting about that is sometimes you come across copy that is sort of in the guise of like something that worked 5 or 10 years ago. And it's that Frank Kern, like going for the jugular kind of overly salesy copy. And it's all grounded in data. You know, probably there's some copywriting masterclass where they're like, this has gotten this sort of conversion rate or whatever. But what I think is interesting is like the idea of cycles and trends and like the clothes change, styles change. And you see people using copy and it's like seeing somebody in bell bottoms sometimes. It's like, dude, this doesn't work anymore, which is an interesting thing to think of trends and cycles for everything, you know, especially marketing. One thing that came to mind earlier on is when you were talking about the additive fallacy or whatever that term of art was, the tendency to add more things. And, you know, maybe that's an itinerary where you're going on vacation, everybody wants to add more stuff to the trip. And I'm not super old, but I'm like 35. And as I've gotten older, I've noticed like I'm more open to cutting stuff off. I'm more okay if it was a trip, for example, doing less. I don't have to see every site. Kind of the idea of as you get older, you know, exploiting versus exploring. So to bring this to a question, hopefully, like, do you think that that age and experience is a component to simplifying?
Oh, that's interesting. I think so. I think there's a couple moments in the book where I quote different folks, and from the two that come to mind are, so Dieter Rams, famous designer, who inspired Johnny Ive and Steve Jobs. His big thing was less but better. And that's the kind of thing that really only you get to once you start to realize that more isn't the answer. And because we are biased inherently towards doing the more, we almost have to see it for ourselves that it's not always where we want to go. It's not always what's going to end up landing for us. And the other story that I like that does relate to age was from Bruce Springsteen. And so talk about creative leadership. When he had his first band, he, you know, there was the Castiles. It was just, they were chaos, right? They were getting arrested. They couldn't get their act together to perform. It was a whole mess. They had a little bit of success, but they ultimately fell apart. When he began working on what became the E Street Band, it was very important that it was not a democracy. And he says something along the lines of, democracy doesn't work in a rock band. He's the boss, like that's his nickname. And it comes from that idea that it's ultimately his responsibility to create that great work. And it's, you know, it's his name in lights, but it's also his name on the bill, right, for that. And so it's not to say you can't do stuff collaboratively, but going back to what you talked about before, the groups, having that maturity helps a lot when you say, okay, this is the person that's in charge of this component. It doesn't mean having a dictator again, who's having a facilitator. This person's responsible for this. That helps you get to the part, to the end point that ends up being simple. Because everything else, complexity is, there's a lot to hide behind. And there's a lot of, again, there's evidence of your work when you're adding something and there's not otherwise. So that ends up being something where you need to have that kind of level of experience and status to really make use of that.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I guess hopefully I can phrase this the right way. Like, is there a way that you can mitigate the risk so that people don't feel like they have to hide behind complexity? Like, maybe that's cultural, maybe it's in values, but if that question makes sense, I'd love to hear your thoughts on it.
Yes. And it ends up being, you have to kind of understand the beast. You have to look at some of the research that I include in the book about saying, okay, well, why is simplicity important? And we haven't really talked about that a little bit, but why is it relevant? Well, it goes back to this idea of fluency. So there's cognitive fluency, you can say perceptual fluency, processing fluency. They're all flavors of the same thing, which is fluent things are easier for the brain to process, are easier to understand, to make use of. And, you know, listen, we can be fluent in English, we can be fluent in Spanish, Mandarin, we can be fluent in cooking or chess. There's lots of different things we can be fluent in. But how it applies here is to say, this is easier for my senses to actually pick up, you know, this higher contrast with this image versus that image. It's easier to read this text than that text. This website loads faster with easier to use UI versus this one. Or even something in terms of names. You know, this name is easier to read. This name is harder to read. There's a really wide range of research that support the basic conclusion of things that are more fluent, we're more positively predisposed towards. When you look at images that have a higher contrast from the figure to the ground, we rate those as more beautiful. Even when you account for ethnicity and for spelling and for everything else, the names that are longer and more difficult to pronounce from like lawyers will impact their overall career when they track that data later. There's a partially kind of absurd example in the book, which you may remember the study was pretty famous, went around about 10 years ago, of ticker symbols, right? So when your company goes public, you can choose a symbol between a couple characters and five characters or so to represent your company. Something like Google is Goog, right? G-O-O-G. Something like Verizon is V-Z. You can pronounce Goog, but you can't pronounce V-Z. And when these researchers looked at the performance of a bunch of companies that went IPO over a certain period that had pronounceable names, they were more likely to pop higher on the first day of trading than the companies that had unpronounceable ticker symbols, just because it was easier for your brain to kind of wrap around it and to make use of that information. The effects eventually dissipate, but not entirely ever, actually. So even years later, there's still a slight benefit to having something that is more fluent versus less fluent.
Right. That makes sense. And even without the data, it's just all things being equal, it's intuitive that would be a good thing to do, to name it something memorable, pronounceable, et cetera. So that's all super interesting. To shift gears a little bit, can you talk about teaching? How did you get involved in that? You know, how has it inspired you or helped you? And what's that experience been like?
Oh, yeah. I love it. Teaching is the best. Like I recommend this to every single person that I meet that is ever curious about doing it. You have to want to do it. You can't just be like, this is going to be good for my career or whatever it is. You have to really enjoy the act of doing it. But I have been teaching at Baruch College in New York City for about, again, this is going on, going to be my 10th year that's starting in a couple of weeks. And I have a class, depending on the year, sometimes it's 40 students, sometimes it's 80 students, and they're undergraduates, they're seniors, they're marketing majors. And so it's this exact moment where they're about to transition from being a student to being a professional. And I love to be there for that. I love to be there to explain some of the stuff that we talk about, like in this book. I love to be there to explain some of the stuff we talked about earlier in this conversation about like running a business and like what's it like to work in the industry. I started doing it because it was at an alumni event. I was talking to the department chair and basically was offering to see how I could help as a practicing agency owner. And they basically said, hey, why don't you teach a class? That's an unconventional way of getting in. You know, that's a simplified version of the story, but most people don't just kind of walk in and do that. But I really took to it. I really enjoyed it. And I call it my favorite hobby because CUNY doesn't really pay. I mean, they pay, but it's like adjunct salaries at a public university are not particularly lucrative. So you do it for the joy of doing it. And I've learned a lot from them as well. And that's a cliche thing to say, but it is definitely true.
Yeah, that makes sense. And are there any interesting stories from that? Like anything that you've brought in your horizons about or think about differently by having gone through the process of teaching? Like, has that informed the book and so on?
Oh, yeah, for sure. So the thing that I've learned the most about recently has been when I started teaching, I was in my 20s, and I was kind of in the same cohort as a lot of the students. And there was a lot of common ground between saying, hey, I used AOL Instant Messenger. You used AOL Instant Messenger. So I had a MySpace. You had a MySpace. As time has gone on, and this is like one of those, you are very acutely aware of getting older and being replaced as the younger generation. I have been really grateful to have that connection constantly to a kind of a my own little private focus group of like 21-year-olds. And I have begun to dedicate a class every semester now to just doing like a focus group. I send out a survey at the beginning. I ask them for a bunch of like, what social networks are you using? How much time do you use your phone? And I will then discuss that. We'll spend an hour in class talking about it and getting people's perspectives and their experience and their perceptions. And that's become something that I end up writing up a little report about them every semester because I was like, okay, this is really interesting stuff. The students enjoy reading the report. I enjoy sharing it with some folks. I have it on my website. You can take a look. And every semester, there's something new. There's something different, you know, about how much time they're using on something, what their perceptions of influencers are. And then that ends up being a really good guide, actually, for some of the later lessons we have in the class, because we're able to kind of jump into things that are more interesting to them.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I know we're going a little bit long, so it's kind of like wrapping this up. One question related to that is, you know, it seems like society kind of gets more and more age stratified. And I basically know very few, if any, Gen Zers, maybe like a cousin or two. So I guess maybe to zone it in on marketing, like what are the Gen Z, what are they interested in? Like, where do you see that talent going? Are they going into the agency world? How would you describe the talent coming out of these sorts of classes?
Yeah, I would say if there's any trend that is kind of linear going, you know, from 2014, whatever it was when I started till now, there were more people interested in going agency. There were more people going in client side, kind of the more traditional, what you would do. Now I feel like I see a lot more folks that are interested in, you know, working at a startup. And this might just be the change of demographics kind of in my class as time goes on, but, or being like a creator. And that was, nobody was a creator when I first started that as like a job. But I remember years ago walking down the street and I heard a toddler talking to his parents. Because when I grew up, I want to be a YouTuber. And that was probably about 10 years ago or so. And so that kid is probably not quite in my class yet. But it gives you a sense. It's a really intriguing path for a lot of people. Because you don't have to, not everybody has to be Mr. Beast or, you know, Kim Kardashian. And in fact, a lot of them don't spend any time keeping up with the Kardashians. But I do ask about that too. But a lot of them are saying, hey, you know what? I could be a fitness influencer. I could have a few thousand people that follow me. And that could be my job. Right. And they're interested in that being, they don't have to be the biggest person in the world. They just say, hey, I'm going to sell a couple courses and I'm going to do a couple brand deals. And if I have a few thousand people that buy everything I do, I don't need to go get a job somewhere. And so that's been something that I've that I've seen change a lot in those past 10 years.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'll have to see where it goes. So Ben, this has been so much fun. Where can people go to check out the book and get their hands on it and so on?
Yeah, likewise, Dan, this has been awesome. So the book comes out from Barrett Kohler Publishers on October 10th. It'll be available wherever books are sold. You can check it out at my website, bengutman.com, BENGUTTMANN.com. The name is not super simple. It has two T's and two N's. Everybody always forgets the second N, but different guy. He's very nice, but bengutman.com has all this stuff, including the book, including a newsletter I do. And if you want to go check out the blog there, you can find some of those reports from my class that I wrote up.
We'll get all that linked up. Ben, thank you so much, man. Appreciate it.
Sounds good. Dan, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to this episode. Again, today's episode is sponsored by our company, Sales Schema. Sales Schema helps agencies and B2B service companies build a reliable business development system through tasteful and targeted outreach. To learn more about us and check out our latest video training, again, you can go to salesschema.com/takecharge. Again, that's salesschema.com/takecharge.